So we are in the season of Epiphany, and our topic today is one that I care a lot about, and at the same time I feel very awkward at. It's the idea of hospitality or welcome. And have you ever met someone who just kind of exudes welcome, like you just kind of relax in their presence, or you look forward to being in spaces with them? That's a rhetorical question. Don't answer yet. We do have our question coming, though. But a couple of months ago, I was trying something new at a workshop I was at called Circling. And it's basically you walk around and you pair up with people who you've never met before. And then you have a lot of eye contact, which is super uncomfortable. Yeah, raise your hand too if there's seats. You've got seats open. Yeah, so we've got some over here. Okay, awesome. We should have this just be kind of a part of our practice. So we've got some good seats over here too. So take your time finding a spot. So I'm doing this thing, circling, making lots of eye contact. And then so we change the person we're standing face to face with. How many people find a lot of direct eye contact intimidating? Yeah, okay. It's fine. If you don't, that's cool. I respect that. I'm learning. I'm growing. It's a growth edge. I paired up with this person, and then they said, now I want you to just tell this person your impression of who you think they are. And I was like, this is so problematic on so many levels. So I'm like, all right. So I'm just take a deep breath. And I'm intuitive, but I'm not psychic or anything, which might surprise you. But I said to this person, I said, you seem like a person, I kind of hedged my bet, that really delights in bringing people into your space and making them feel at home. And then the person started crying. And I was like, did I do it wrong? But then they started nodding. I was like, oh, whew. Because there was just something about this person that exuded welcome to me that made me feel like I would love to go and have a meal in your space. So I want us just to take a minute around this question, maybe with a person or two sitting around you. What do you find difficult or enjoyable about welcoming others? Okay, so just take a minute, maybe think about it. If you love it, what do you love about it? If it's hard, what's hard about it? So maybe share one or two things with someone sitting next to you. What were some words maybe that came up around welcome, what you find enjoyable or difficult? What do you think? Vulnerability? Yeah.
Comes natural?
Yeah. That's great. I'm jealous. That's good. Protectiveness? Yeah. It's what else?
Performing?
Yeah. Huh? Yeah, and I'm sorry. I actually, both of my ears are clogged this week. I don't know why I'm trying to hear you. I'm just going to trust y'all had really awesome, profound things that happened in that interchange. And I'm going to quit while I'm ahead. Or breaking even, maybe. Our first Sunday in this space, 2 weeks ago, I'm better now, but I was actually recovering from a head cold. So this is a different thing, maybe, maybe not. So at the end of liturgy, I was just tired, and everyone got up, and I was the only person sitting, and it was really beautiful just watching the community and how we were interacting. And after a little while, Claudia and Cole actually just saw me, and they just came over and sat by me for a minute. And I don't know why, but that felt really meaningful. And we didn't really talk. Maybe they were tired too and they wanted a rest. But I felt kind of welcomed or embraced right as I was in that very kind of tiny gesture. And sometimes when we think of welcome, we think of really large gestures. But deep welcome is composed of hundreds, maybe even thousands of little welcomes. And this morning, we're going to lean into the large and small ways that hospitality unravels the fractured world we too often encounter and slowly recreate spaces where access and belonging can happen for all of us. So I want to invite us to read aloud together, as is our custom, from the Gospel of John. about Jesus' first miracle. So at this point, Jesus has gathered some students. He's a teacher, a rabbi, and he's started teaching a little bit, but he hasn't really done anything that cool yet. So many think this turning water into wine at a wedding party that they were all invited to was his first miracle. And I also just want to acknowledge that alcohol is very complex in our culture. It did function differently at that time, at the time this was written. Personally, I grew up with an alcoholic father. I have a functioning alcoholic brother. So I just want to kind of acknowledge that it's sometimes hard to get at what Jesus was actually trying to talk about or the meaning, which I think as we wade into together, it'll be clear it's about welcome. But when I was like breaking out of kind of my conservative mold and I read this, I thought, yeah, Jesus is like pro-alcohol. And because that's what repression creates, is like you're looking for permission, right, to do anything. But he's actually like pro-hospitality. Like that's the point of the story. So we see through this passage that hospitality is a community experience. It starts off on the third day, there was a wedding in Cana of Galilee, and the mother of Jesus was there. Jesus and his disciples had also been invited to the wedding. When the wine gave out, the mother of Jesus said to him, "They have no wine." And Jesus said to her, "What concern is that to you and to me? My hour has not yet come." His mother said to the servants, "Do whatever he tells you." So they're in the middle of this wedding, and it says when the wine gave out, which to me sounds like the title of a really sad song or like a novel, like when the wine gave out, you know. If you write that, you can just totally take credit for it. But they're somewhere in the middle of this like week-long feast where they're eating and they're drinking and they're telling stories and they're sleeping. Like, can you imagine? And the worst imaginable thing has happened. They ran out of wine. And I think it's hard to overestimate how much of a disaster this was. Like, it would be like, I don't know if you've ever been to Comic-Con, like we've got an image here, with no costumes. Or if that's not like something you're familiar with, it would be like standing in a long line for a taco or barbecue, and then when you get to the counter to order, they've run out of your favorite thing, right? This is like whatever reference point you need, it was bad. This was really bad. And it would have been a source of shame for the families being joined, but it also would have been a shame shared by the extended family and friends of everyone who came to the wedding. Because it was ancient custom that everyone coming would bring gifts of wine and food to help with this week-long party. Running out of wine wasn't just a failure of the families being married. It was a failure of community. And it probably likely indicated like a lack of resources or means at the time. A lot of their resources, they were being gouged by the empire that occupied them. So, but regardless, I actually think Mary, Jesus's mom, is the actual real hero of the story. Because it says, the mother of Jesus said to him, "They have no wine." And Jesus said to her, "What concern is that to you and to me? My hour has not yet come." I love this exchange. I imagine it somehow brings up Jesus' inner teenager for a second. Like how all adults like can fall back into that around someone who raised us, right? Because his mom is like, "Son, they have no more wine." He's like, "Mom, leave me alone. Like, why should I care? I'm hanging out with my friends, playing my abacus or marbles or whatever the video game of the time is." But she knows like he can do something about it. So even though he says why, there's something I think like nonverbal happens, because then she says, "Okay, get ready to do what he's going to tell you to do." And he does it. I imagine Mary maybe like gives him a look, you know, like, "Really?" And he sighs, you know. Or maybe he's actually moved with empathy for the social disaster that this is. Or maybe like inner teenager Jesus is like, "Fine, whatever, I'll get off the couch and do it, geez." You can't tell that I have teenagers, but wine though was a symbol of the community welcoming and hosting one another. And Vox, as a community, We envision this as a space where we are welcoming one another. Like one of our places of welcome is even in our language for our children every Sunday. Usually we say this before dismissing them to greenhouse. We welcome the sounds and spirits of our little ones as they discover their place in community with God, themselves, and one another. And if the kids could understand it, we would also have them say something like this with us. We welcome the needs and spirits of our adults who are also discovering their place in community with God, themselves, and one another. Because as our children are growing, we hope that they'll learn early on the joy of being a host and participating in the welcome of others as they're ready. And parents, you're doing a great job, by the way. This is not parent shaming. And you may not feel that most days, but I'm in awe of our parents here, so please hear that. But as a community, we hope that we will kind of take this on, like this idea that our little ones can come to know God without shame. And our vision is to be a community where everyone is learning to welcome everyone, older and younger. Because as a community, we can either create a culture of welcome or we can create a culture of exclusion. And every time we meet, we get to decide who we're going to be, which I think is really cool. Like most of us, I have too many experiences of feeling I'm on the outside. My experiences of not feeling welcome are kind of like a really funny and bad series Jen and I watched recently about Vikings. And there's one, I'm going to share a clip. It's just kind of a little bit of a preface. There's one Viking in particular, Orm is his name, who rises to become the head of their village, and then he loses everything and becomes a servant. And Orm really struggles to find his place, and he has many painful experiences of trying to kind of insert himself and then being excluded. So let's take a look at this.
Seriously? You're having an after work meet without me, even though I was the driving force of this exact concept?
No. This was totally accidental. I mean, I just had to get up and pee, and I think all of you also had to just get up and pee.
I was just airing my old...
And I was just airing my...
Yeah, so this was kind of a spontaneous thing. It's nothing planned.
You all know that the spontaneous things are the ones who turn out to be the most fun. You know, it's maybe because you have low expectations and you can relax a bit more, you know. So it's just pouring salt into the wound, saying that it was spontaneous.
Yeah, sorry about that.
God, my best friend and workmate, you know, sneaking out like this. You know, we're practically blood brothers.
Either you are blood brothers or you are not.
Do you know why we don't take you on these social activities?
No. No, honestly, I don't.
No, okay. It is because if you were here, we would all be sitting and having to listen to your boring anecdotes and fables.
No, my anecdotes are nothing but extremely interesting.
No, they are not.
Odd.
No,
please.
Nobody here is interested in what you have dreamt and what your dreams might mean. It's extremely boring.
You know what? All of you... In general, and you specifically, Kark, you have hurt me more than anyone has ever hurt anybody ever.
I'm really sorry. No.
After a long and strenuous journey, you have just reached the peak of Mount Hurtfulness. You have climbed to the pinnacle of the hurt tree. You've shattered the hurt ceiling, and I hope that you are proud of yourselves.
Come on, Odd. Just come here, sit down, take part in the festivities. I mean, I saved a rat drumstick for you here.
No, it's too late, it's too late.
Autumn.
You know, being excluded by the ones who are at the bottom of the social ladder, the subhumans.
Autumn.
No, it's too late. Too late.
So sad, right? So when I watched that, like, I laughed so hard, but like it was in tears because I immediately didn't identify with the people sitting in the circle. I immediately, like, oh, that's, I have like an inner Orm, you know. They even pretended to save him a rat drumstick. But that, I think the power to give welcome and the power to receive and feel welcomed are the same, actually. And so often we show up and assume that everyone has been here forever. Why isn't anyone reaching out? Yet our community, the community of Vox, is pretty fluid. Most of us, most of the time, feel ourselves to be the outsider waiting to be brought in. So I'd like to invite us, as is kind of some of what was talked about last week, just to welcome someone at Vox in the next couple weeks. Like anyone, someone you know, just to say, hey, welcome to Vox. I'm glad you're here. How long have you been here? And you may find yourself a little bit more on the inside than when you started, because our brains actually take in the reality we extend as though it's happening to us at the same time. It's pretty cool. Jenna and I had like a debate. I think it's mirror neurons. I'm not sure. But that's like, there's a physiological thing that happens that supports that kind of thing. I think this is why throughout Scripture we're invited to welcome others, because it creates belonging for those being welcomed and for the welcomer. One of my favorite things at Vox is when someone welcomes me. It happens about once every 2 months. Like, say, hey, welcome to Vox. How long have you been here? I'm like, oh, thanks. I love it, because I think those, to me, reflect God's vision of how we carry the power to welcome equally. And as we lean into hospitality, as we go into our passage a little deeper, we see how welcome messes with our expectations. Now standing there were 6 stone water jars for the Jewish rites of purification, each holding 20 or 30 gallons. And Jesus said to them, fill the jars with water, and they filled them up to the brim. He said to them, now draw some out and take it to the chief steward. So they took it. When the steward tasted the water that had become wine and did not know where it came from, though the servants who had drawn the water knew, the steward called the bridegroom and said to him, everyone serves the good wine first, and then the inferior wine after the guests have become drunk. But you have kept the good wine until now. So did you do the math? Like, okay, 6 jars holding 20, 30 gallons, like 120 to 180 gallons of wine. That's a lot of wine. And then he says, why are you serving the good wine last? It, like, for them, that was a waste of money. But if you're going to do that makes sense. But if you're going to do a miracle, like, would you really make like box wine? I mean, they're just not quite getting it. Or if like maybe the equivalent, if you're a beer drinker, like, would you turn water into like Coors Light? No offense, like cheap beer is often like a decent Pilsner, but would you make Pilsner with your miracle? Or would you make like maybe like a Chimay Trappist Abbey beer? That would be my preference. But understandably, he made good wine, but it was out of sync with the normative expectation. And I think that's what we find, is that hospitality is often disruptive. They were expecting this to be like every other wedding they've been to, but the wine got even better right when they expected it to become barely tolerable. And I think as humans, we can't help but have expectations. Like, it's part of our evolutionary adaptation to recognize patterns and expect certain things. However, our unmet expectations are also the source of our greatest energy drains and disappointments. I want to offer a delicate example of this. So one of the most loaded ideas in our culture is marriage. There is so much expectation about how we are signing up to be welcomed by another for life. Like expectations of how it will fulfill our picture, the belief that it will give us uninterrupted joy and love and meaning, which is really beautiful. Can I share with you the best quote I've heard about marriage this week? So this is from a 60-year-old woman who had been remarried for three years and was back in therapy because of her new marriage. And this was something her therapist shared with her. So marriage is getting to know someone's craziness at a granular level. And if you want to stay in it, you've got to be willing to get to know your own craziness at a granular level. So we could say it like this more broadly, the intimacy. So any deep relationship, whether it's with another person or a pet or with God, is getting to know their and our own craziness at a granular level. Is that what we think of when we think of signing up for a relationship? I think that's what it is. I think this is really funny, but I'm sorry if it's... Stay in it longer. This will get funnier over time, I promise you. But most things we sign up for, whether it's a job or a friendship or a community or a marriage or a child, are not going to be what we thought. Like, sometimes they're even better, but at some point, they're very disappointing. And the thing we actually have some control over is our ability to host our expectations, to incrementally adjust what we anticipate moving forward. So I want to invite us just to practice that for a minute this morning. So maybe consider an area of disappointment right now. Could be a friendship, could be the city, could be traffic, could be your living situation, a job, marriage, a dating relationship, not having a dating relationship, a child, life, just life itself. What emotions are there, if any? Just notice. Just invite you to welcome any emotion that's there. It's okay that it's there. It's just part of being human. And then consider, do I need to take a half step back or a half step in? Like, are you getting overwhelmed all the time? Maybe it's time to take a half step back and get some support and look at it. Or maybe, like a lot of us, whenever we put ourselves out there, we're invested and we get hurt, we get disappointed, we pull like all the way back. Like, I can become like the kid in the sandbox. It's like, got hurt and fine. I'm gonna, like, gathering up all my toys. Like, I'm gonna go home and play by myself, you know. So maybe we've pulled too far back. We need to actually take a half step back in. And I wonder, as a community, if we could ask this question together. Like, how can we live in the tension of what we hoped for and what is? Because we're all working through some version of life not being what we thought, right? Because the need to adjust our expectations, I think, is a daily thing. We can't help but expect, and it rarely ends up being how we thought it would. And part of expectations, I think, that get messed with in our text today is we start to also see how spiritual reality reverses the outsider and the insider structures. So look at just the flow of information in the passage. It starts off with Mary, Jesus' mother, and then it moves to the servants, right? And then from there, it flows, and his students were also in the mix. And then it flows to the steward, and then finally to the wedding coordinator. The steward's like the wedding coordinator, to the bride or the groom, and then the wedding party. So the flow really is from the people with the least amount of power to those who have the most, are the last to know. And really only Mary and the students and the servants get to know about the miracle, right? It's not clear that the others even understood what had happened at the time. So if you find yourself on the outside of healing or intimacy or community or meaningful work or experiencing God, or maybe even having faith or trust that God even exists or cares, I would just say to hold on, because you're in the place of someday getting a first look. Like, you're not forgotten by God. Like, a day is coming when this world as we know it, it will change, and a new world will emerge that will find those who have found, and all of us in some area of our lives feel that. In that area, you'll find yourself somehow on the inside again, or maybe for the first time. But until that day, hold on, because it may take a while. But we see through this passage that God is closest to the spaces in our lives where we find ourselves on the outside. Last week, Virginia and Gideon, I think, did a beautiful job of helping us start a conversation that we hope to be sustainable around privilege. And I want to say that it's important that we experience Christ hosting us in complex conversations. In fact, I kind of, as I was listening, imagine Jesus is hosting this beautiful dinner party and inviting us to talk about complexity. And as we pass around the food and drink, we're being invited to engage in conversations that are generations deep around systemic racism and sexism and fear of immigrants. But to be able to have a conversation that doesn't have to be sustained or require a shooting or the courage of women coming forward or the insanity of actual walls being talked about, being built, what the hell? Like, that our conversation hosted by God doesn't require pain just to be had, but it's had because it's necessary, because people are affected. And Christ hosting this doesn't require my shame, though, to keep the dinner party going. That's not a great dinner party. One of the complexities for me in the past few years is coming to grips with the load of just personal trauma, shame, anxiety, and anger that was given to me growing up. So just the work of healing and trying to find breathing room has been a lot. And sometimes I've entered the conversation around my privilege as another burden or a message that I'm not a good person. And that's not really helpful, but it happens, right? I can say that this is not the dinner party Jesus is inviting us to. Healing acknowledges we're all carrying different loads of pain and shame and trauma. And when the conversations lag, let's hear the invitation to bring them up again. And when we stumble into shame, let's lift our eyes and remember our deepest identity is remembered in his eyes and wounds. Christ hosting us will allow us to engage the cultural markers we benefit from and are punished for without losing sight of our deepest, deepest identity as beloved. Like, we can hold both truths, that you and I are truly loved. And it is this table, the table of the beloved that we come around behind me, our Eucharist table every week, because that's the foundation of our party. So this insider-outsider reversal came up for me most recently around the new Spider-Man movie. Have people seen it? Okay. So I need to publicly apologize for making fun of teenage Peter Parker Spider-Man a month ago. I don't know if you were there. I'm sorry. I was maybe suggesting he wasn't as effective an Avenger as the others. So I'm sorry, teenage Spider-Man. And to others who were offended, there were some people offended. I apologize. We good? But the new Spider-Verse has actually like kind of blown my mind. So we're going to watch just a quick trailer of it.
My name is Peter Parker.
I'm pretty sure you know the rest. I saved the city, fell in love, then I saved the city again and again and again. Look, I'm a comic book, a serial, I did a Christmas album, and a so-so popsicle. But this isn't about me. Not anymore.
Spider-Man swings in once a day, zip-zaps up in his little mask and answers to no one. I love you, Miles.
Yeah, I know, Dad.
You gotta say I love you back.
Dad, are you serious?
I wanna hear it.
Look at this place.
Dad, I love you.
Dad, I love you.
That's a copy.
My name is Miles Morales. Brooklyn! I'm the one and only Spider-Man. At least that's what I thought.
You ever hear of the Super Collider?
You're gonna love this.
Dimension opening now.
You're like me.
That's impossible.
All right, kid, listen up.
This fry is your universe.
It's soggy, it's weird, it's gross.
And this delicious normal fry is my universe.
So you want to learn to be Spider-Man.
Can you teach me?
Yes, I can.
Time to swing.
Ah,
good,
doing
you're
it.
Doing it. Double tap to release and whip it out again.
Okay.
Swip.
And release.
You're a natural. Swip.
Hey, guys.
Who are you?
I'm Gwen Stacy. I'm from another dimension.
How many more spider people are there?
Hey, fellas.
Hello.
This could literally not get any weirder.
It can get weirder.
Okay.
We need to get back to our universes soon.
Brooklyn is going to collapse. My family lives in Brooklyn.
Whoa.
Miles, what's wrong?
This was never your city. It's mine.
If I don't destroy the collider, none of us will have a home to go home to.
Remember, what makes you different?
Let's go!
Is what makes you Spider-Man.
Officer, I love you.
Wait, what?
That way, that way. Other way, other way, other way, other way.
Do animals talk in this dimension? Because I don't want to freak them out.
So, yes, we need to have a movie night. So when I watched it and I saw, at first it's just enjoyable. Like, I didn't know I would enjoy it. It was really pretty amazing. But there were all these different reversals as I thought about the movie throughout the week. Like, the identity of Spider-Man as one hero, it gets dispersed into, like, now there's a new Spider-Girl, and there's, like, this old noir Spider-Man, and there's a Japanese anime Spider-Girl who's awesome at robots, and there's an animal Spider-Man or cartoon pig within a cartoon. At first, like, when I saw the trailer, I was like, that's too chaotic, like, that's too much. But as I actually entered into the, and then there's, like, old pudgy white Spider-Man, which is the voice of Nick from New Girl, who is, like, super grumpy and reluctant, and he finally agrees to mentor Miles, who's the teenage Spider-Man, who is biracial. And then, sorry to spoil it, but it all gets flipped, and the role of savior-mentor totally reverses. The identity of superhero gets spread out and shared in all these amazing ways. And I realized as I thought about the whole, like, Spider-Man franchise and the meaning and stories our culture and our kids need to grow up with now, I thought, oh, the good wine is being brought out now. Like, you saved the best for last. These are the stories and parables we need now that embody God's vision of equity and mercy. Because, friends, we're being invited into God's dream of hospitality and welcome that is about us learning a welcome that transcends every barrier and messes with any story that says you are invited but not really welcome. I mean, in our hall, it says welcome, welcome, welcome. That is what God, I think, is breathing over this space and this community. So might we move into our power to create belonging by practicing welcome today and this week. If you're nervous, come welcome me to Vox today. I love it. Like, if you just need to practice, I would love it. And might we ever be adjusting our expectations incrementally and with grace as we struggle together to make sense of a life that is rarely what we thought it would be. And then in all the things, perhaps we can see how God's best justice and best healing and mercy are still to come, and that we can hold on to a bit of hope much better together than we can alone. This is my prayer for us, beloved, beautiful Vox community, in the beauty of our God and community, Holy One. Amen.